Inspired by ESPN's anniversary, ESPN Films 30 for 30 is an unprecedented documentary series featuring 30 films from some of today's finest storytellers. Each filmmaker will bring their passion and personal point of view to their film, detailing the issues, trends, athletes, teams, rivalries, games, and events that transformed the sports landscape from 1979 to 2009. For more on 30 for 30, here's your host, Bill Simmons.
All right, welcome to the 30 for 30 series, The Legend of Jimmy the Greek, premiering Tuesday night, 8 o'clock ESPN with a rerun Monday, November 16th, ESPN2. And right now, you are looking live at the BS Report, somebody I've always wanted to have on. I don't know why he hasn't been on sooner.
Yeah, where you been? I've been waiting for you to call. Everybody else calls around here, but you don't.
I know. Well, Mr. Brent Musburger, you should have been on long before this because it is staggering how many great live sporting events you've been to over the last 35 years. I would put your list against any broadcaster ever. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, hard to measure yourself, Bill. The one thing about me, I try not to live in the past. It is remarkable. I went to a Bengal game yesterday in Cincinnati with my son, busman's holiday, beat the Ravens. And it was amazing to me, Bill, how many people came up and talked about different games and different things throughout the career. So, I've been lucky. You were just a young'un when Doug Flutie performed Hail Flutie on that Friday afternoon that you watched. And how many people come up to me and talk about it? It's just remarkable. Year after year after year, you can't go anyplace in college football without a discussion. So but basically, I've been lucky. I show up, and for whatever reason, we get more than our fair share of good games. So I've been blessed. It's been fun.
Well, here's a list that I was able to come up with of things that you have been involved with, either as a play-by-play guy or studio host. NBA Finals, March Madness, the Masters, basically every kind of college football game that could be had, Little League World Series, all the horse racing, the World Cup, Super Bowl, College World Series, Indy 500, Rose Bowl, and you even did studio host for Monday Night Football for 5 years. Basically, you've done every single thing that I can see except for the NHL. Oh, the Olympics. The NHL and the Olympics were the two that...
But actually, the Olympics I did for radio, so...
What about tennis?
Oh, I did a lot of tennis. Hosted the U.S. Open for a number of years. During the reign of McEnroe, he found it hard to speak with me at times because we had a producer who just loved his rants. And we would open our shows with McEnroe ranting about this. You remember the ones.
Of course.
And of course, Mac would take it personally back in the day. So it was a tough interview. But that was the old days of the U.S. Open. Jimmy Connors and McEnroe, then Yvonne Lindell came along. And Bill, I grew to really enjoy tennis, to tell you the truth. A little bit like boxing.
Right.
Mano-mano, trying to break somebody down. And so that was great fun. But you mentioned the NHL. I've always jokingly said, can't pronounce the names, can't do that. But I grew up as a newspaper man, in fact, my first Siberian Husky was named Makita, after you-know-who.
Right.
And my second one was named Jockeman, after you-know-who. So back in the day, I've always told people, because I know you have favorites and how much you grew up a Celtic fan and all that, and it's great to look back. I've always said that the six-team National Hockey League may have been the single greatest league in my lifetime. Now, you have to remember now, they weren't wearing helmets.
Yeah.
I think his name was Masterson of Minnesota. He hadn't died. And so the women in particular loved hockey, the flowing hair. Bobby Hull would come down the wing. I mean, it was flat exciting to watch those guys play. And then
you had rivalries, too.
Teams
that hated each other because they played each other 14 times.
And they only made about $15,000, $20,000 a year, by the way.
Yeah.
So you didn't take sick. You weren't injured because there were always a couple of guys in the minor leagues who were going to replace you. And, big money because of... because of what helps you and me, a television came along, and now, of course, the worldwide internet and everything. And so the economics of sports has changed dramatically through the years.
It struck me that I don't know a ton about you personally, and it seems like you did that by design. You were always one of those guys, you're about the game. and that was it. And we never knew a lot about your personal life, things that were going on. Was that by design?
Yeah, a little bit. And then I've loved the game so much, and I'm pretty boring. You know, I've only had one wife.
Right.
You know? And so I would have been bad copy for Deadspin back in the day. You know, they would have never been able to track me down.
Wait a second. I disagree, because the fist fight with Jimmy the Greek
would have been three weeks in Deadspin. That was big. Yeah, that would have been that would have captured a headline on Deadspin. No question about it. All right. You had a great, great memories, Bill. That the Greek was upset, because he thought I was paying too much attention to Phyllis. You know, back in the day, we only had 30 minutes in that pregame, and now what have they got? 3 hours, so you can give everybody all the time they want.
And you were like the quarterback. You actually had to disperse the playing time to each person.
Exactly. And so the Greek and I unfortunately wound up in the same place drinking some fine Cavassier. Oh, it was wonderful going down, and then a few words lead to another. But everything was okay. One of the executives called, and, we're going to fire him. We can't have this. And I said, no. I said, settle down. We'll be okay. I said, tell the producers to come up with something next week. I said, it's like a couple of brothers get into it. I said, it's a family feud. It happened to be a public one, because sitting there at the bar were a couple of guys who worked for the New York Post. And, of course, that doesn't help you when you're trying to keep a fight quiet. So it broke out. And then the next week we had boxing gloves and rang the bell, and everything was fine.
I think I was 10 or 11 when that happened.
Right.
And I can totally remember watching that next week, waiting to see, number one, whether you guys would even be on the same set together, and then, number two, how you would handle it. And I still remember the boxing gloves, even now.
Yeah. I've got those someplace, Bill, in a garage in Montana. I have them stored, okay?
Yeah.
I took them with me that night. Don't think I got the bell. I think we borrowed the bell from somebody in New York. But I've got the gloves still around. I sure do. Yeah.
Now, you know, as people, what we've found with this 30 for 30 series so far, you know, I'm 40, you're right, older than that, but you forget that people like under 30 or under 25 have no idea that stuff happened. Like, for instance, we ran the Len Bias thing last week,
right. And
I was getting emails from people under 25 that basically were saying, I had no idea that guy was that good. And I was like, yeah, of course he was that good. He was the Michael Jordan of forwards of that decade. I think the same thing translates to, you guys were the first studio show, and now we have a million studio shows. We have 8, 9 people on every studio show, but you guys basically invented it, right?
Yeah, you know, Bill, we were lucky because we were the pioneers, and I would love to take credit for it, but the credit belongs to a couple of producers. Bob Wessler certainly was one of them. Bill Fitz, who later helped establish ESPN, they were the two guys whose ideas came together, Bill Fitz always had the idea of bringing all the highlights and games into a central clearing area. In fact, they had come into Chicago for some post-game shows, and a late sportscaster, a dear friend of mine, actually, Bruce Roberts, had done some post-game shows. And so the next step, when Bob Wessler became head of the network, he said, you know, let's bring it in New York. And on top of it, let's take our pregame show, which was then called Countdown to Kickoff with Jack Whitaker and Pat Summerall.
Oh, yeah.
Let's make it live. And so Bob called me and he said, you know, I know you know Irv Cross because you both went to Northwestern together. And what do you think? Would you like to do it? And I said, I'd love to do it. I said, tell me what time to be there. And then about a month later, he called and he said, Brent, did you ever hear of a Miss America by the name of Phyllis George? I said, no, Bob, I can't say that I have. And he said, well, we'd like to add her to the show. What do you think? And I said, well, fine. You know, I think it's a grand idea. So that's how it started. The Greek did not come on until the next year. And again, it was a phone call in the summer. And Bob said, Brent, do you know Jimmy the Greek? And I said, yeah, I frequently go out to Las Vegas. I said, he's a charming fellow. I've been out with him. Character. Great PR man, loves to talk about football, and so we added him to the show, and that's how it all began. But being there first was important, but I must say, as time went along, and I saw what Chris Berman and the gang were doing up in Bristol with the post-game show, mm-hmm. I thought the handwriting was on the wall, that because they had more time and they were dedicated to sports, that eventually the universe would shift a little bit. And it certainly has. And I've told Chris through the years that I've envied him because of the time he had with the postgame. You have to remember when I was signing this off the air, we would deliberately run the Dallas Cowboys or the Washington Redskins. They were both really good in that time. We would deliberately run those NFC teams late so that we would dump a huge audience into 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes had virtually failed on a Thursday. Yeah. And I've always said the National Football League made 60 Minutes because we would drop that great audience in there, and then, of course, they would keep it in and do the rest. But because we were going to 60 Minutes through the years and because they wanted to get started right away, it was basically 60 Minutes is next. Good night. See you next week. And meanwhile, you would flip over to ESPN, which was in a few million households then, and Chris would have all the highlights ready to put up on the air. But it was an interesting time. And yeah, you know, Bill, yeah, it's like you youngsters come to you and, gee, I'd love to do your job. How can I, you know, I can't teach anybody luck. You know, you're at the right place at the right time. But I can only tell you, if you think it's a great opportunity and you think, hey, this is a chance, really make the most of it. Really nail the door shut and do the best job you can every day. That's about all I can tell them. But it was a great time.
That's good advice. I think the one thing, you know, in fairness to you, there was only like 5-6 channels in 1976. So exactly. You had such a bigger audience that was available to watch your show just by out of the fact that there wasn't competition. So you guys did have to dumb it down a little, and you did have to have Phyllis, and you couldn't be as like football extensive as maybe the ESPN guys were.
Absolutely. You know, we couldn't make it all football. We had to have some personality up on the air, and we had to have some glamour, and you exactly put your finger on. We could not be totally hardcore.
And what was a riskier move, Phyllis George or Jimmy the Greek?
I think the Greek, simply because of the National Football League's, you know, nervousness about admitting that gambling has played any part in their success. Now, you and I know, and anybody who really knows anything about the league knows, that there were some bookmakers back in the day who helped found the National Football League. And
yep.
Most people really believe that without gambling, the National Football League would not have taken off to the extent that it has. I'm not, you know, I want to make myself absolutely clear about gambling. And the Greek taught me this. There's only a handful of people in the country who, let's say, bet $20,000 a game. That is such a small number. We could probably name them on one hand, and that would be it. That, all those guys, okay? But it is the people who participate in office pools, who survival pools, all of these things that go on for a man-to-man. If Bill and Brent disagree about the Patriots when they go play Indianapolis and we have a beer, I'll bet you $20 on this and that. That's where the bulk of the money moves back and forth, is
right.
Smaller amounts of money. And, of course, if you add it all up. But I think that it is fun taking a position on a football game. And it was dicey. Bringing a Greek in. Now, we could never mention point spreads, Bill. I mean, he could give his checks, and you were supposed to interpret each check mark represented how many points.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I would get in trouble every year because at the end of the last NFC Championship game, I would always give the spread for the Super Bowl because I always thought people were fascinated in who the favorite was. And the league would always come down, and I'd get a call from on high, and, hey, you shouldn't do that. Oh, and I said, I forgot. I'm sorry. It won't happen again. And, of course, the next year it'll happen again, but that's the way it was in the day.
Well, the Greek did have some code words. And
I remember
as a young fledgling gambler in my teenagehood, like, you know, the Greek would say, maybe the spread for Washington-Dallas would be Washington by 3. And the Greek would say, I like Washington. I like them big, Brent.
Yeah.
They'd be like, okay, we get it, Greek. You think they're covered. Or they'd say the opposite, like Washington would be favored by 13 over the Cardinals. He's like, I like Washington, but I like it to be a tight game, Brent.
Exactly.
You're like, okay, we get you, Greek. But do you think in this day and age somebody could even be on TV with a moniker like The Greek?
Oh,
I feel like it's so politically correct now that it'd make him just be Jimmy Snyder.
Yeah, you know, it was accepted back in the day. I don't think anybody thought about it, to tell you the truth, back in the time. It's a very good point because the political correctness world certainly has shifted. And, you might be right. Maybe he would just be Jimmy the Snyder.
Well, you watch the documentary, and it's striking that this guy was a major television star, and you watch him, and he's this guy with a Vegas background. God knows what kind of weird connections he had. His name is The Greek. Right. And this guy was like this beloved figure in America. It's almost like impossible to explain to anybody under 30 right now.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true. He was a caricature. You know, he was a people did like him. I mean, I've been with group. You know, I always loved to go out with a Greek to a Super Bowl. If I was going to a restaurant, I always took the Greek because mm-hmm. I knew we wouldn't have to wait long for a table. I mean,
right.
The Greek on one side and Phyllis on the other, and man, you were set for the night. Let me tell you that. But yeah, it is hard to explain. You know, and I hadn't even thought about that till you mentioned it. My boys were very young at the time, and I can tell you that they adored the Greek.
I did too.
He was very nice to them. The Greek loved children. I mean, he was very sincere about that. And,
yeah.
Kids, yeah, they enjoyed being around him. Yeah, he was fun.
So when you found out, you know, and he was kind of on the downside by the time he torpedoed his career at the end there with Omar Epps, but walk me through when you found out about what he had said and what the collateral damage was.
Well, you know, my wife and I had been out to one of the Smithsonian's that afternoon, and I was unaware of what had happened. I knew that he was going out to shoot a man on the street. And when I came back, the lobby was jammed with people with cameras, and I was like, what happened? You know, I thought maybe my first thought was somebody was sick or there was some incident in the hotel, and somebody gave me some sketches of the Greek did this, and of course, you know, word of mouth gets passed along, and the first story was exaggerated to an extent. I mean, it was way off the mark. And, of course, I went right upstairs and called the producers and found out, you know, what had happened. And it was, you know, one of those ironic things. It would have never happened if the camera that he was working with hadn't broken. They were shooting basically a man on the street trying to get how the fans felt about the football game. And when the camera went down and they went back to get it fixed, that's when he went into the restaurant. David Brinkley was over there sitting at one table. Duke's was a famous place in Washington. And the Greek was at a different table. But they came over to get a comment from him. And you know, the rest of it we know.
Yeah.
And how unfortunate, but how unlucky he was at the time. I mean, it was just one of those things.
And it was a more forgiving time at the time than it is now, and it still was a gigantic deal, and it became clear almost immediately that he had to go off TV, correct?
Yeah. You know, Bill, let me just say this, that there were so many. For example, it was an NBC station that taped it and asked the question, okay? I've always wondered what would have happened had it been a CBS station. I don't think they'd have sent it out on the late afternoon feed. I mean, there were so many ironies involved in this and so many just unlucky things that happened to the Greek that afternoon.
So you don't think those comments, in your opinion, reflected the person that he was?
Oh, definitely did not.
Yeah.
Under no circumstance. I will tell you this. Hanging around the Greek as much as I did, he was an old school guy, came from a different generation, but I never, ever felt that he was in any way a racist, not in the least. You know, he wandered into an area where he probably shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
And
maybe had a few drinks in him.
Yeah, you know, the story was, and I think Jimmy told me this later. Let me stop right there. He swears to this day, and so do some other people who were with him, that he wasn't drinking when he went in. Because my reaction was the same as yours, okay? Immediately, I thought he had a few cocktails. But he swore to me that he didn't. And I know some other people who were at that table who insist the same thing. And the Greek was not a lunch drinker. The Greek really wasn't a big drinker. I mean, he'd have a, you know, like the night we were at Pear Trees and a fight broke out, he'd have a few cavassiers after the show. I mean, there was no question about what happened that particular night. But I think it was the Greek. If it wasn't the Greek, it was somebody else told me that that Al Davis had started discussing with him the evolution of athletes from Civil War time, and that he sort of stuck in his memory bank. If you go back, he was really trying to be complimentary, and he just didn't know how.
Yeah, it sounded like he was repeating a theory that he had heard from somebody else and
did it
so clumsily that
it was so
clumsy. Made him think it was his thing.
Exactly. And when you first heard it, just, oh, my goodness, what But then,
right.
If you stop and you read it and you think about it, and now if the Greek had been a college professor, you know, he'd have probably pulled it off in a discussion basis. He probably right. would have been able to discuss it, but that, you know.
It's just everything about it is horrible. He looks bad in the shot.
Absolutely.
It's totally out of context.
No question.
His
no
point question. Is offensive, obviously.
Yeah.
And it just, yeah. none of it went well. So he yeah. was, in your opinion, never the same after that, correct? Like just
no, it was a sad demise. And I was always hopeful that somebody would pick him up and give him another chance. And for whatever reason, you know, they never did, and it really went downhill.
Pretty fast.
Yeah, it did. It really did, Bill. It was sad to watch.
So when you think back about him now, what are the three emotions that you have?
Well, first of all, he was an endearing character for me, and I really enjoyed working with him. I thought that he brought a flavor to the show that we could not have gotten from almost anybody else. The fact that my family, my sons liked him so much and still have a three-wheeler around one of the barns out in Montana that the Greek gave to them. And of course, you know, we will kid about the Greek from time to time. And, you know, wouldn't the Greek have loved this? And wouldn't this year's Breeders' Cup have busted the Greek? And, you know, because he loved the horses, and I was around the horses with him a lot, too. So, you know, most of it's anecdotal, you know, when we yeah. think about Jimmy and we think about Phyllis burying her, you know, her head in her hands because the Greek was insulting just, you know, seconds before we went on the air one day. I mean, he could be very coarse now. He could be very crude. I mean, he was of that world. And remember, he'd been a busted bookmaker. And so it was Nixon who gave him a pardon and all. I mean, the Greek had some background when you go back to his days at Steubenville. So he was a legitimate American character, okay?
Yeah.
There was no question about that.
When you're together with Phyllis and Irv, it must feel weird not to have him there, correct?
I'll let you know after tonight and tomorrow.
Oh, but you guys haven't been together since?
No, they're coming in tonight. We have been together once since the breakup of the show.
And wow.
CBS actually brought us back in to have a get together. I think we were in Las Vegas actually, and they filmed it for some retrospective that they were doing.
Holy mackerel! I had no idea about that.
So it was, you know, we've all kind of gone our different ways. And
have you seen the documentary?
My one son has watched it and says it's very, very good. Okay, and I have not seen it. I actually am looking forward to seeing it. But Blake said it was very well done.
All right, cool. All right, we have a couple other things to hit.
Sure.
Rocky II.
Another
in my opinion,
character.
Here's how I'd rank the great moments of Brett Musburger's career. Number five, you were the studio host of the 86 Masters.
Right.
Number four, Nova Georgetown, you called it.
Right.
Number three, Flutie's Hail Mary.
Yeah.
Number two, the triple overtime game, 1976.
Yeah.
A six-year-old Bill Simmons in attendance, asleep on his dad's lap.
Really?
Three other people.
How could you sleep, Bill?
I was.
Come on.
You remember, it started at 9 o'clock.
Oh, I did. Listen, do I ever remember on a Friday night, okay?
It was there the drunkest crowd of all time,
of all
right?
time. All time. And Rick Barry hid inside the Phoenix Suns locker room. And, of course, you'll love this story. Because we were getting paid, all of us, by the game, okay?
Really?
So you better believe that I was pulling for a seven-game series, and you were probably, your father probably told you that, you know, that group is really pulling for the Suns in games three and four, and
yes.
and your father was absolutely right. And
I've heard the tapes, and you know, because I was been writing this basketball book, and they got me the DVDs.
Right.
You rooted really hard for the Suns in games
no
three
question.
And four. I can vouch for that.
No question. I want to go back dead even at two, and then you guys were on your own, you know, okay?
Right.
So Rick Barry, he can't take it because Red Auerbach has just lathered up the town. You know,
yeah.
Will McDonough was one of his favorite guys, and he's blasted us in the Boston Globe. And this town is really ready, okay?
Yeah.
And they've been drinking outside the old train station that night, a pay night in the Boston Garden. And I walk in, and they're throwing insults, not to mention cups and a couple of bottles.
Oh,
and
boy.
We go in. I actually had to have a policeman peel a fan off of me. At courtside, because I went out and stood out there as it was going. You remember how hot it was when it got started. There was no air conditioning in the old place. It was, but it was one of the great events that I was ever around, you know, and the Celtics rushing into the locker room as though they had won it once and coming back on the floor and Westfall's performance and McDonald in the triple overtime. And that was a great night.
I wrote about it in my prologue. So I fell asleep in the second half because by that time it was 10:30 at night and I was six. Woke up at the end of the second overtime only because everybody was standing because we were taking the ball out of bounds. We were down by one. That was the play Havlicek made, the running one-legged banker.
Yeah.
And then everybody charges the court. So I've been asleep for like an hour and a half, wake up, see that shot, and then everybody kind of tramples us to get onto the court because we were behind the visitor's bench. And then just everything after that, I have a hazy memory of seeing all of it. And there's just never going to be another game like that. There will never be a drunker crowd. You're never going to see a triple overtime game end at 1 in the morning. You're never going to see a ref get punched. I mean, when is all this stuff going to happen again?
And remember now, the Celtics called an illegal timeout.
Oh, the Suns did. Yeah. And, Paul Westphal.
And, no, Paul Silas.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Okay.
The game should have ended.
No,
yeah, you're right.
It should have been Suns win. And so for the rest of the night, Al Bianca and John McLeod and several of us drank beers up in a hotel room talking how Red Auerbach, he ran the NBA. Whatever Red wanted, Red got. But actually, Red was a dear old friend of mine. I really liked him. And as you know, I mean, there's nothing like the Celtics and the Lakers when they get together for a championship. But this one was special when the Suns were there. Okay, so you went 5-4-3-2. What's number one in my career, young man?
Yeah, number one is Rocky II.
I figured you were headed there.
It was not only – see, there's two types of cameos that a media personality can make. One is that you're just gratuitously thrown in the movie.
Right.
Two is like you can actually play a key part in a plot point.
Right.
You played a key part in the plot point of Rocky II.
And here's
you were essentially, in my opinion, you got robbed as supporting actor.
I've always thought so. So nice to have you say that. Well,
seriously.
Well, you know what's interesting about it, okay, is you look back and look at the movie, and you think it was written into the original script, but it wasn't, okay?
Uh-oh.
And 24 hours before I tape it, I'm not even thinking, I didn't even know Rocky II was being made, but I'm living in Los Angeles at the time. And I get a phone call by someone who actually went out and recruited bit players for movies. He'd been at Northwestern with me, and so I had known him way back in the day. He said, "Brent, can you help us? We really need a favor." I said, "Well, what do you need?" This old hotel downtown Los Angeles, he said, I need you to come down and work with Sylvester Stallone. We have to get from A to C, and you have to help along the protagonist here. And B. And I said, "Well, you've got it all ready for me and everything you want." "Yeah, sure." He said, "I know you've got to be on the air in the afternoon. This will take you hour and a half, whatever."
So was it clear to you that you would be in the movie? They never told you. Okay.
No, not clear at all. Okay. I didn't know what exactly they wanted. I walked down, an old room, and it had all set up, you know, as kind of a studio set. And there's Stallone himself right in the middle of it. And he could not have been nicer. And by the way, let me add, that I thought he really knew what he was doing. I thought he was in charge of everything that was going on and what he wanted. And he explained to me what he wanted me to say and what they were going to have Burgess Meredith watching the scene. And I said, "Fine." I said, "Just, you know, give me about 10 minutes with your script and I'll be glad to do it." He said, "We don't have a script." I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "We would like you to just kind of make up a sports cast, but this is the point we want to make late." Okay. This
yeah,
is
but
point.
You could do that in your sleep, though.
So I said, "Okay, we'll do it." So I did it. I shouldn't tell you this because this really sounds like I'm bragging. But I finish it. And he said, "That's great." He said, "That's just what we wanted." I said, "Sylvester, well, you want me to do it a second time just so you..." "No, perfect. Ideal." And the cameraman gave me a standing ovation because obviously I presented them an opportunity for an early break when they were shooting. And they did one take, had what they wanted, And the rest is, you know how they use it. And Burgess Meredith's in bed, and he doesn't want Rocky to come back and fight again. And there I am needling him and trying to egg him on to come out. And they run the interview. I was not any part of the interview, actually, even though it makes it look like
right.
I did not do that. They taped that someplace else and ran that in. So that was...
You helped cause Apollo Creed the title.
Apollo is
if
that?
If you never give that sports cast, Rocky never comes back. Apollo's the champ. Everything, he never dies against Ivan Drago.
I know.
It's all you.
It is amazing, okay?
You were also in The Waterboy too, right? You haven't been in a lot of sports movies.
But the Waterboy now.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a Disney movie, okay?
Yeah.
And because Adam Sandler had been so successful in The Wedding Singer, okay, and had made so much money for Disney, they left him completely alone with Waterboy, okay?
Yeah.
He and his buddies from NYU got to do the whole, nobody interfered. There wasn't anybody on the set or anything. And he was another guy who knew exactly what he was doing. And he had a little bit of an idea of what they wanted with the script. And so Dan Fouts and I ad-libbed a few lines. Fouts' best line of all is, you know, "Shut up, Brent," which, you know,
right.
always tickles the family when they hear it. But we got done with that, and that took a few hours of the afternoon. We shot that in Orlando, and that was the ballpark where they had the game. But I was back, Bill, back in the summer in Montana, not thinking much about it, and the director called me and said, "We'd like to come to Montana. Do you have a studio you can get for us? We'd like you to do the lines on the play-by-play over for us so we get a better recording." And I thought, well, they've tested the movie, obviously, and they know that they got something that's going to sell, or they wouldn't go to this trouble.
Right.
And it came up, and I did the voice over again for all the play-by-play. We didn't reshoot the on-camera with Dan Fouts and I, but they came up, and then I knew, and they had tested it, and of course, I mean, that was an enormous, enormous financial hit for Adam and for the Disney family. So that was great fun being around Adam Sandler. He was another really interesting, very nice guy to work with, and I thought knew what he was doing, okay? I want to go back to Rocky because it led to something else.
All right. Are you going to talk about the main event?
And Barbara, and this is a totally different kind of an ending, okay?
So hold on, but before you go on, the main event was this boxing movie that Barbara Streisand made with Ryan O'Neal that she probably had one of the five worst hairdos of all time in the movie, and I'm convinced that's why it didn't make it. It was like this ghastly red poodle perm, and that was it. It killed the movie right there.
No question. What a great memory for movies you've got.
Oh, anyway. You have no idea. All
okay, right, so the same fellow calls me and says, "We've got a problem. We need somewhat the same thing that you did in Rocky. Would you come and help us out?" And I said, "Fine." I said, "You know, I've got to be on the air so I can give you a morning." And I said, "I've got to be out around noon or so. I've got to go over and..." At that time, I was anchoring the news with Connie Chung. And so I go over. And Ryan O'Neal has just read the review. He's got the New York Times in his hand on Oliver. And they had just crucified him in the movie, okay?
Yeah.
He's devastated, okay? He's not able to talk. I thought he was going to break into tears. You know, I'm drinking a cup of coffee there all alone. They slap on some makeup and say, "Okay, well, Barbara will come out. We'll get this over." So she comes out, I don't know, a couple hours later. And, yeah, she's got that bad hairdo. She walks over. She didn't look down. She didn't say hello. She didn't do anything. She walked over and she said, "Ah, the color of this background is terrible. I can't do this. We can't shoot this scene with this color." And I'm thinking, what the hell's going on here? And she says, "Change the color, do this, and I'll be back." And she leaves. I said, whoa, what kind of power is this?
And it thought you had power.
Yeah, it took 3.5-4 hours for him to repaint the set, okay? So now she comes back. She can't remember my name. She got no clue who I am, okay? So that's still in the movie. And we go ahead and we shoot. And you had to shoot every scene with Barbara. She would not allow the camera to film one side of her nose. It was only the one side that she would allow, okay?
Really?
The one profile that she would allow, and the certain colors. So she's married to the old hairstylist. What was his name? John Peters? He was
John Peters.
He was the producer of the movie. He came in for her. You know, Barbara Hal, oh, you look great, sweetheart. It's going to be wonderful. Turn around and walked out. I said, uh-oh, we got a bad one here.
Yeah.
Then the director comes out. Okay, we're in the middle of this. We haven't even got the take they want. And Ryan is still upset that the New York Times has devastated him. And I'm looking at my clock wanting to get out of there. And I finally have to call the station and say, look, I hate to tell you this, but I can't make it tonight.
Yeah.
You know, they were a little bit upset, but they said, okay, it's, you know, being a station in Hollywood, they understood. And they said, okay, go ahead and finish the movie up, which we got that ridiculous scene done at about 11 o'clock at night. Okay.
Ugh.
And it led to a huge argument between the director and Barbara. She wasn't going to sing a song. And the director knew that he had a bomb on his hands. And the only way you could sell a Barbara Streisand movie is she sang a song. So he got into this loud, screaming match with her. You've got to sing a song for us, or we can't sell tickets to this movie. And I got to tell you, Bill, when I walked out that night at 11 o'clock and went home to Arlene, I think the first words were, I said, Arlene, my movie career is over. Now, I did go back and do Waterboy, but I got to tell you, it was over as far as Hollywood was concerned. I said, oh, no more of that nonsense. We're not going through that anymore.
That explains your 17-year absence between movies. Wait, I got to ask you, because I wrote this 700-page MBA book, and a lot of it, well, not a lot of it, but a nice chunk of it is about how screwed up the NBA was in the 70s and you know, this had become the league of basically selfish black guys who did drugs. That was how it was perceived in America. And you guys were tape delaying games. I mean, CBS. It was a league that really was in a lot of trouble with the public perception of it. And then as you guys were showing the games, it gradually evolved into what it became. Was there ever a point when you were involved with the league that you thought, wow, it's just nobody's ever going to give this league a chance. This isn't going to happen.
Well, I was devastated when the championship series on tape delay, the Philadelphia Lakers. I thought that was ridiculous because I thought Magic Johnson was a big time star. And
think about that. They tape delayed a series that had young Magic Johnson, Dr. J, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and it was tape delayed.
Yeah. So therefore, if you were a sports fan, you were cheering hard for ESPN to really get involved because they wouldn't do such a ridiculous thing as that. There was no excuse for doing that. That did lead, by the way, to the fact that the championship series is not played until June, okay?
Right.
Which is ridiculous to me still to this day. I think it should be done no later than mid-May. I think the playoffs should start the week after the Final Four because basketball interest is peaking, and I think the playoffs should be underway. And I will go to my grave saying that thing should not be running into June.
But when I did the research on this, though, it actually made sense why they tape delayed it because of May sweeps, and there was only five, six channels back then, and they didn't want to preempt Dallas, which had 30 million viewers whatever.
No question.
So they could show NBA.
Oh, no, it made sense. If you're looking at it from making sense from my bosses, there's no question. But if you're looking at making sense from those of us who liked the NBA, it was ridiculous, okay?
Well, how much crap did you take at the time for NBA, they're never going to make it. All those guys are
in
drugs.
No. I took more crap from people who were upset about the games being tape delayed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no. I took much more because remember, I would be around the basketball crowd.
Yeah.
I was, you know, I knew that there was that distant chorus, okay, that was loud. But those of us who sat at courtside and watched guys like Dr. J and then Magic and Larry Bird and Kevin McHale and all those guys and watched them sweat in front of you and work hard. Oh, no. We were dyed-in-the-wool NBA basketball fans. I mean, there was none of that with our crowd. If you didn't like it, we figured, all right, go on about your business. We can exist without you. We never thought about being defensive about it. We thought this is a sport that you should appreciate because it's much better in the playoffs. It's much better than the last 5 minutes. I will still argue that with anybody. Now, during the regular season, 82 games, they cannot do it physically, night in and night out. They have got to sometimes save themselves and you decide the game in the last 5 minutes, but not when the playoffs start. Those guys are still the greatest athletes in the world, and a great playoff series. There's nothing like it in sport, I'll tell you that.
Well, I don't think people realize how influential you were during that stretch. That was really tumultuous for the league because, really, they weren't marketing themselves at all. And it was basically in your hands and your hands alone to come up with nicknames, to get excited about the sport. Nobody else was excited about it. You were literally the only media guy who was excited about it.
Yeah, exactly. I took a lot of heat for it, but the Wizard and all of my friends with nicknames, I have great memories about those guys, whenever I see them.
The Mountain Man.
Oh, the Mountain Man.
You also, I'm almost positive you came up with the initial nickname. Because you were calling Charles Johnson CJ.
Yes.
And Dennis Johnson DJ.
DJ.
And I don't think...
DJ
in that...
and CJ. I remember that the first time we did it. And absolutely. And now, every time I turn around, I say, what do those initials stand for? And now they give them to more than athletes. That's not fair.
Right.
Broadcasters should not have initials. You know what I'm saying? I should just reserve that for athletes.
And so by the time your CBS tour ended, there you were. You were at the NBA was... the hottest sport, and
absolutely,
you were there
absolutely.
From the depths, and you experienced the other stuff too. Well, thank you so much for being part of the 30 for 30. Couldn't be
700 pages you wrote on the league, I hear.
Yes, huh? I would love for you to read it at some
point. I'd like to.
They mailed me like 150 extra DVDs that aren't really shown, and you did the play by play for most of them, and that 70 starting with 74.
Yep. Yep.
All the way through to basically, when did you step down? Like 84, you just did studio?
Yeah, then I just did the hosting of it.
I wrote about the famous time when they had Moses as the pregame, halftime, postgame.
Goodness.
One of the weirdest decisions ever made in network television. And he was doing halftime analysis for you.
Oh, man, I'm telling you.
You had to work hard that day.
Well, I thought about using subtitles, but just didn't have the technology at my fingertips. And
He made Dr. J look like the greatest TV guy ever by comparison.
No question.
You also, Oscar Robertson, the first year, Elgin Baylor, the first year, they got rid of during the playoffs, right?
Yeah, they brought Rick Barry out. Okay,
right.
And got rid of Elgin. But I didn't work that one.
Oh, that's right. It was like Pat Summerall, maybe?
Pat did that one. And then the next year, I came in and worked with the Big O.
And that didn't go that great.
No, the Big O... if they'd have stuck with him, and I'd have had a little more experience, we might have been able to do something with him, though. Because he's, Bill, he's a pretty perceptive guy. Critical, too. I mean, no one was ever as good as the Big O. I mean, there was no question about that. And there was a famous line in the New Yorker, I don't remember it now, but it was the Big O's game until he decided to give it up. It was somewhere along those lines. People don't realize because he didn't. He could never conquer the Celtics. They don't realize how great he was. He is up there with the Jerry West with all of them. Oscar was an unbelievable talent.
Do you think he's the most underrated player you've seen in the NBA?
Yeah, only because, as I listen to people talk about the legends and everything, and, of course, the Lakers winning and Jerry going on, I would call Oscar... you could do a lot worse than starting your all-time team with Oscar. I know it's hard to look past somebody like Bill Russell, who won all those championships and was such a great defensive player. But if you chose Oscar, I'd say, okay, that's okay by me.
I thought the best job of all the games that you did, and I'm sure you have a favorite, but I just thought the Bird Dominique, you just crushed that one. I was at that game, and that was one of the greatest atmospheres I've ever seen in person.
Wasn't that unbelievable?
You could sense that it was coming. Yeah. That's what made it great. Once they started trading the hoops, it was like, uh-oh, it's going to happen.
That's right.
And the crowd rose to the occasion, and I just thought that was great. Anyway, I'm going to have to bring you back because we need to talk about Rocky II some more.
Okay, Carol.
It could be another 40 minutes. Just on Sly.
All right, lad.
Brent Musburger, enjoy the doc.
Thanks for coming on.
Okay,
okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
What if I told you that for three glorious years, football season never ended? That a marching band played a 12-year halftime show? What if I told you that a rugby scrum could help heal a nation? Or that the guy sitting in aisle 4, row 8, seat 113 was going to be more famous than anyone on the field? What if I told you that a movie could change the way you look at sports? From ESPN Films, 30 stories, 30 filmmakers, 30 years. ESPN 30 for 30, presented by Levi's, continues Tuesday at 8 Eastern on ESPN.